Bono, The Rolling Stone Interview.
I'm Jan Wenner. I'm the editor and publisher of Rolling Stone. Bono is on the cover of the latest issue. Their U2 is in the middle of a really exceptional tour of the United States. They just finished five nights at Madison Square Garden in a one-week period, just a week after I did the interview with Bono. We did it down in Mexico when they were on a break in the middle of their tour. Spent the weekend in Cancun at his house. And rain was pounding down outside. We were in the middle of a tropical storm down there. So we were kind of locked in his house, and, you know, halfway through the interview, you know, it's thunder and lightning, and, you know, it was kind of in the, just, you know, right on this beachfront house outside of the city of Cancun in a little more remote spot. You know, they had caught like a 15-foot boa constrictor the day before, wandering around the, you know, snaking around the property, and, you know, we just sat down, just started to talk. He likes to talk. He talks brilliantly. Did about 10 hours of taping. It's a pretty exceptional interview. He's an exceptionally eloquent man of passion and conscience and the gift of words and an inspired band, a great musician, songwriter, and a man with a mission. So without further ado, here's some excerpts from my interview with Bono.
Tell me about your childhood. Where you lived, what Dublin was like as a city, what it was like to be Irish as a kid. There was a bad economy in Ireland then. It was pretty repressive Catholic Church situation.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, when I meet African finance ministers now doing my data work, I love to remind them that 20 years ago, the Irish economy was down the toilet and the IMF and the World Bank were on their way to take charge of it. Ireland is a miracle of turnaround. Now, the second most prosperous country in Europe, only to Luxembourg, which isn't really a country. Mean average wage, highest in Europe. Mm-hmm. Ireland, second, like France, Germany, England. Mm-hmm. It's really extraordinary. But in the 70s, this was not so. And so I grew up in a, you know, kind of reasonable, what you would call lower middle class a neighborhood. You don't have the equivalent really in America. Upper working class, I don't know. My dad had a car, which means you couldn't call him working class, and yet, you know, most people on the street didn't. In between two very working class areas, what Americans would describe as projects. So in the back garden of where we grew up in this suburb, they built the Ballymun flats, they were known as, which they've just torn down in the last few weeks. And on the other side, there was Finglas. And we had a confused address, and in fact, as kids, the order of the day was often being beaten within an inch of your life by roaming gangs from one of the other neighborhoods, who, when they asked you where you were from, you had to guess right or suffer. But you know, a nice street, good people. And yet, if I'm honest, overpowering sense that violence was around the corner, and it was, you know, that's one very strong memory of growing up. If you're just talking about the local. The neighborhood where I grew up. In the house, I think pretty regular three-bedroom house. Third bedroom was a tiny little room about the size of a cupboard they called the box room, which was my room. No later when I had a record collections, the Joy Division room. Mother, who departed the household early, died at the graveside of her own father. So I lost my grandfather and my mother in a few days. And then it became a house of three men. And three, it turns out, quite macho men. Mm-hmm. And all that goes with that. And again, more aggression. And the aggression thing is something I'm still working at. And, you know, that level of aggression, both outside and inside, is not normal or appropriate. And if you ask the band about early rehearsals, they were very aggressive. I mean, most people wouldn't call it rehearsal; they just call it one long row. And if it didn't get physical, would certainly most rehearsals were screaming matches. And as I look back and I realize, I was probably doing a lot of screaming.
I was trying to get a sense of you're like this bright, struggling teenager, and you're like in this place that looks like very few possibilities for you. Is that a correct sense of it?
Well, it's funny, you know. Here's Bob Hewson, my father.
My dad.
Comes from the inner city of Dublin, real Dublin man, but loves the opera. You know, must be a little grandiose himself, okay? Loves the opera, is an autodidact, completely conversant with Shakespeare, all the classics. His passion is music. He's a great tenor. And he would tell you until his passing, his great sadness of his life was that he didn't learn the piano. Oddly enough, no piano in our house. Oddly enough, kids not really encouraged to have any big ideas. Mm-hmm. In fact, I would say that my father encouraged us not to dream, because to dream was to be disappointed, and which is, of course, explains my megalomania, I'm sure, because if you're told not to have, so the idea of going to college, it's like get a life, just like get any old job, become a salesman, I think was what they thought, and in fact that's what I have turned into, a salesman.
But do you think like the general attitude towards you from your father and just the Irish attitude in general is, who the fuck do you think you are? Get real, and you're like this dreamy kid, or.
That's right. Well, I mean, I was, I think I was a bright kid, all right, early on, but then in my teenage years went through a sort of awkward phase of, thinking I was stupid, my schoolwork goes to shit, I can't concentrate, and if you like, I started to believe the world outside. And the world outside, of course, tells you that's true. But music was my revenge on that.
I mean, I got the sense that some people it was kind of really a kind of a dead end situation that you had to fight your way out of. Find your way.
Suburbia in Dublin is a very strange thing, or very not strange thing. It's blandness. It's very grayness. Is the thing you have to overcome. So our revenge on it was music, was technicolor ideas. you know, we had a street gang that was very vivid, very surreal. We were sort of fans of Monty Python. We were early surrealists.
What did you do as an early surrealist? What was your street gang doing?
Like, you know, just put on performances in the city center of Dublin. I'd go get on the bus with a stepladder and an electric drill and, you know, just mad shit.
Go into the city center and just do
surreal stuff. And humor became our weapon to defend. Because remember this, the order of the day.
What did you do with the street with the ladder and the drill?
Just make up shit. You know,
just like, go
one
put
act,
up and
one act plays. You know,
start yelling for the public.
Just stand there quiet with the drill in your hand. You know, just stupid teenage
just provoke people
shit. Provoke people.
Know what the fuck are these?
And
performance art.
Performance art. And we invented this world which we called Lipton Village, and out of which now there's serious painters and musicians and lots of people have come out of that. But we were teenagers when we came up with this, and it was a way of fighting back against the prevailing boot boy mentality.
What's the boot boy?
Boot boys were in the 70s. The hard men, you know, they had bobber boots, skinheads, mm-hmm. boot boy culture, mm-hmm. which was,
were you going to fight against them? Would they come and attack you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was constant.
So you'd go out like a bunch of art students?
Yeah, it was kind of like that. Yeah, it was, I mean, there were different people like Gavin Friday, who's just doing the movie with Quincy Jones. He's doing the music for the 50 Cent movie now, and is an amazing performer in his own right. He was the most surreal looking. He had an eraser head haircut, you know, he wore culottes. Okay, he wore dresses and bobber boots. And it was again, the harder they hit us, the more strange and surreal.
The
response.
Kids, the freaky kids?
Yeah. And, I mean, myself and there's a my other friend, Googie, who's still a very close friend and is now, you know, exhibiting with Tony Schifrazzi in New York. And, you know, he and I were, you know, handy enough. We could defend ourselves. But others couldn't. And it was just a sort of, you would be harassed for your difference, and even though we became pretty good at violence ourselves, some of us, others didn't, and others got the shit kicked out of them, and it really is a mark. Because I thought that was kind of normal, but now with 20 years behind, I realize that actually isn't how my kids are growing up, or how anyone I know's kids are growing up, and though teenage boys bump into it, just they're going to at some point. They don't live with it constantly, like we did.
Quite as aggressive about it.
No, I mean, it is. I mean, it's honestly, I can remember incredible street battles. I remember one. I remember one Manzer. With an iron bar, just as trying to bring it down on my skull as hard as he possibly could, and holding up a dustbin lid, which saved my life. Teenage kids are so, they have no sense of mortality. Yours or theirs.
Nobody was exercising any restraint on you? Except
no,
your
no,
dad
no,
is
my
trying
old man
to...
Would, I mean, occasionally you'd walk in and there'd be boot marks on my back and he'd say, what were you doing? And I'd say, you don't know what it's like out there. And he'd say, shut up. You know, it's a perfectly nice street. And, you know, that kind of thing.
So that was your teen rebellion?
Well, I don't know if that was rebellion. That was just defense. That was a defense mechanism. Yeah, rebelling against the order of the day. Yeah. We used to laugh at people drinking. We didn't drink. Because people who spilled out of the pubs on a Friday night and threw up on the laneway, we just thought we thought we were better than them.
Were you the, you were the smart kid?
We thought, no, we're all smart. I mean, one of our we would collect all the different outsiders, a collection of outsiders, and they weren't all the the clever clogs. It was like it was an interesting. People who had, you know, really, it was people who had, if you had a good record collection, that really helped. That was kind of the rite of passage into our gang. And if you didn't play football, and even though I love the game now, and it was just, that was part of it. Now I look back, there's an arrogance to it too. It's like you're looking down, really.
At the jocks.
At the jocks, at the skinheads, at the boot boys, there's an arrogance to it. And maybe it's the same arrogance my father had, who's listening to and listening and likes cricket because it separates
and he's better than
him.
Us.
So maybe there's a, I mean, I have to accept that there might be some big headed and we might have deserved a good kicking.
What was the first rock and roll records that you had or heard? And what were your initial experiences with rock and roll music?
Age four, the Beatles, I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Age four?
I remember that. I guess that's 1964. When was I Want to Hold Your Hand put out? 63? Is around that time?
Right in that time.
Okay, I remember that. Watching the Beatles with my brother on St. Stephen's Day. Or Boxing Day, as they call it in the UK. I don't know what you call it here. What? Day after Christmas Day.
Yeah.
So it was a big holiday. So the Beatles movies were on every Christmas.
The Hardest Night.
Hardest Night. Help. So the sense of a gang that they had about them, from just what I've been saying, you can tell, connected. The melodic power. As well as the, you know, the haircuts and the sexuality, which it was just probably processing. Then performers like Tom Jones. So you'd see Tom Jones on a Saturday night on a variety show. He'd be like 8 years old. And he's sweating. And he's an animal. And he's unrestrained. He's singing with abandon. He's a big black voice and a white guy. And then, of course, Elvis.
Were you thinking of like Tom Jones in those terms when you're watching then? There's a big black guy sweating.
No, I'm not thinking about black voice, but I'm thinking, what is this? Because this is this is changing the temperature of the room.
Uh-huh. At eight, you're thinking that.
Yes, I'm really knowing that.
Uh-huh.
And people, you know, people stop talking, you know, because, you know, it's a Saturday night, so people are just going on with the Saturday night. But then, if he went into one, and the same with Elvis, when he went into one, people stopped talking. So you notice these things as a kid. Wow, what's that going on?
When did you run across Elvis?
Elvis is probably then, you know, 10... 11, 12 years old. The, I guess the 68 comeback special when it got to the networks. I seem to have seen that.
That was your first memory of Elvis, was watching a singer special?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've heard his, you know, the songs. And then.
When did he first make the question?
That's when it was. I think that's when it was.
What was that big impact Elvis moment for you that you wrote?
Standing up because he couldn't sit down to play, I can't remember the song,
on that comeback special.
This is, he's not in control of this, this is in control of him. You know, you see the abandon was really attractive, the breaking out thing. And then, because next door neighbor, John Brady, was a huge Elvis fan. I was in next door playing with him, and my mother comes out and says, Elvis Presley is dead. I remember that very strongly. So around about 14, anyway, I remember listening to Elvis albums in John Brady's house. And then cut to whenever it was, I'm with him when my mother comes out and says, Elvis is dead. And he's really upset. It's like, he's really taken out. And I am sort of too, but I don't know why as much, because I'm not at that stage. I mean, I'm not that lost to his music yet. That's about to happen.
And then you get lost to his music.
Yes.
You decide after he's dead to go back into it, listen to all, and think of the impact. I mean, what were the other big impacts on you musically as when you're that age, when you start becoming a teenager? What are the groups that really made you?
Again,
was there a conversion moment to rock and roll?
Well, funnily enough, my brother had a reel-to-reel tape recorder, so he had a lot of interesting stuff on it that no one else on our street was listening to. But before I got to The Who, before I got to, the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin and those kinds of things, I really remember John Lennon's Imagine. So now, I guess I'm 12 and 13 when I come to them. I'm certainly not older than 13. That's one of my first albums. So that really set fire to me. It was like he was whispering in your ear these, ideas of what's possible, different ways of seeing the world. And Bob Dylan at the same time, listening to his solo albums, the acoustic thing. And then starting to think about playing those acoustic songs. My brother had a Beatles songbook, so trying to teach myself guitar, him sort of helping. And that song, which is actually such a genius song now that I think about it, but you were embarrassed the day after you learned it.
Which one?
If I Had a Hammer.
Uh-huh.
Right? Mm-hmm. Do you remember that song?
Yeah.
And that's a tattoo, that song.
Aaron Neville just made a fantastic version of that about 2 years ago.
So I Had a Hammer, I'd Hammer in the Morning.
That was the first song you went to play?
Yeah, I'd Hammer.
In reading all this literature about you, I've never heard that before.
I think that's the first song.
Okay,
now we're I'd Hammer in the Morning. So Hammer in the Evening, all over this land. I'd Hammer a song, what is it, a song?
About
I'd Hammer
freedom.
Justice. I'd Hammer Justice.
Freedom. Song about love between brothers and sisters all over the world.
Fantastic. There it is.
Still doing
Manifesto,
the same,
right?
Still doing
there.
The same song.
Right.
The first one was the Peter, Paul, and Mary version of If I Had a Hammer. I guess that's where it first came out.
I guess so.
And so the all that stuff is going on in London, the 60s, the Beatles, the Stones, the Who, the Kinks. What kind of influence was that
Who.
On you?
Now, the Who, that's about age 15 that starts really connecting. Because in amongst the din and the noise and the power chords and the rage, there's another voice. Nobody knows what it's like behind blue eyes. The beginnings of what I would discover as a, what I realize one of the essential aspects for me and why I'm drawn to a piece of music, which is something to do with the quest. I got it from Bob Dylan, or in his case, probably like the the pilgrimage, you know, the sense that there's another world to be explored. I got that from Pete Townsend, got that from Bob Dylan, and so that's all happening around then.
So as a kid, you got turned on first by seeing the Beatles in A Hard Day's Night.
Yeah.
That's the first thing that really got you turned on. Because these guys are having fun as a gang. It's like, I would like to be that.
Yes. That's simple.
And then from there, musically, it's like Elvis and Tom Jones.
Yeah.
For the
big performance. Big performers, big voices.
Big ego. I want to be on that.
The showman.
Do that. And what connects intellectually is Imagine. Is the first thing that really is a powerful thing to you?
Imagine.
And If I Had a Hammer?
Yeah, because
Two Songs of Peace are the first things that grab you as a kid?
Bob Dylan. I think it's the greatest hits. It must have been the first greatest hits he put in, because it had all the stuff on it. It wasn't Free Will and Bob Dylan or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So it's Blowing in the Wind, all that stuff. And the folksy thing, which is, I suppose, what set me up for John Lennon.
Dylan set you up for John Lennon.
Yeah, because it's folk. So you're interested in folk, right? Mm-hmm. In words. Mm-hmm. And kind of, you know, kind of whisperings and the quiet thing. Mm-hmm. You're in your room, which I was, listening on a tape recorder. It's very intimate. On headphones. Mm-hmm. My brother had headphones. Can you get more intimate than being on info? It's like talking to somebody on the phone. It's like talking to John Lennon on the phone.
So it's the plane of voice and a message is coming through to you.
Yeah. And then, you know, you know, this sort of, I'm not exaggerating to say that this music changed the shape of the room, you know, because it changed the shape of what, of the world outside the room, the way you looked out the window, what you were looking at, all of this stuff. I remember thinking, I think it's on Imagine, it must be John singing that song. It's like a little hymn, certainly a prayer of some kind, even if he was an atheist at the time. It goes like, oh my Lord, for the first time in my life, my eyes can see. I see the colors, oh, I see the trees. Everything is clearer in our world. Now, I don't know whether it was off it or if it was just his having fallen in love with Yoko.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it was like he was talking about the veil lifting off, you know, the scales falling from the eyes, seeing out the window, the new clarity that love brings you. I remember that feeling.
That idea struck you then as you're listening to the song?
I don't know if I could have put it like I've just put it, but I certainly, you're looking out the window and you're noticing that there are some trees on your street, and you're noticing that
do you feel he's singing to you in your experience?
You know, yeah, of course, and you're seeing, you know, and that the bus at the end of the street that you can take could take you somewhere completely differently after you heard that song.
You said, you know, about the band, you said that we come from punk.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
So, okay, now it's 1976. 29 years ago, this month. I was in school. I was now the obnoxious teenager phase. No question about it. Schoolwork's going to shit. Angry, living at home with two men. My friends are all going to have big futures because they're very clever. I'm probably not going to be able to concentrate enough
to be that clever. I've always had these melodies in my head. And, in quiet times, at the local youth club in the church hall, if I'm beside a piano, I put my finger on a key. I figure that the pedal under, if I press the pedal, that boom, this note can fill the whole hall. Reverb, turns this church hall into a cathedral. I hear a rhyme for the note in my head. I really do. I can find another note that sounds good with it, and I can feel the things there, but I've had no way to express it. And 29 years today, actually last Saturday, the week before last Saturday, this note appears from this kid, like really a kid. He's 14, I'm 16, he may even be 13. He wants to start a band, plays the drums. So, my friend Reggie Manuel, the Cocker Spaniel, called him, says, "You have to go. You've got all this stuff in your head." So I shared it with him, he's my friend. I said, "I can't do it." I said, "No, I'll take you." So he's a motorcycle, puts me on the back of the motorcycle. And he takes me out to this other suburban house where Larry Mullen lives. Larry Mullen is in this kitchen, tiny kitchen, and he's got his drum kit set up, and there's a few other boys. There's Dave Evans, kind of brainy looking kid, who's 15, and his brother, Dick, even brainier looking, who's built his own guitar, right? He's a rocket scientist, card-carrying genius. We knew about him in the school, and he built a guitar. I was like, who are these people? This kid called Ivan McCormick, brother of Neil McCormick, who's a great writer. Writes the Daily Telegraph, the other place like that. Another other kid called Peter Morrow and Larry. He starts playing the kit. It's an amazing sound. I mean, just like hit the cymbal, it's just silver. And just incredible sounds. He hit a guitar chord, which I'd never heard an electric guitar. It's like opening up the throttle of a much more powerful bike than my friend Reggie had. I mean, it is the open road. And kids start coming from all around the place. They're all girls. They know that Larry lives there. They're already screaming. They're already climbing up the door. He is completely used to this, we discover. He's taking the hose already.
Right. Literally the garden.
Literally taking the garden out. It's like, you leave me alone. And so that starts. And within a month, I meet Annie. I mean, I've met her before, but I ask her out. That is a very good month. And, but what's interesting about it is, I would say, in the months leading up to this, I was probably at my lowest ebb, in my life. I was feeling this, I guess, just teenage angst. I didn't know what to do with my life. I didn't know if I wanted to continue living it, that kind of despair. And, I was praying to a God I didn't know was listening. I'm just listening to music was just giving me some strength. So it's an amazing moment. Mm-hmm. And I'm only reminded of it because last week on Saturday, at the back of the place we were playing in Milwaukee, I met some U2 fans who told me that this was the day that we had played or that we'd come together.
Were you influenced by punk music then? But did you...
No.
The Clash?
No,
or?
This has nothing to do with punk. This is 76, and it's early. It's September of 76. Mm-hmm. Punk has just started in London that summer.
Mm-hmm.
Adam,
goes to London the next summer, summer of 77. Mm-hmm. London's burning.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes back with, you know, he's having been to London, being in the epicenter of punk mm-hmm. rock, the Stranglers, the Jam, mm-hmm. the Clash. Oddly enough, though, in our very first rehearsals, we were talking about what music we should play, and of course everyone would get, so you have their suggestions. And the music I wanted to play was Rolling Stones from the High Tide Green Grass era, mm-hmm. 60s Rolling Stones, mm-hmm. and the Beach Boys. Mm-hmm. And I was getting tired of the hard rock thing.
Hard rock being?
Led Zeppelin. Mm-hmm. And I was saying, you know, let's get back to this rock and roll thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it's at. And then people would say, oh, look, it is. That's happening. Mm-hmm. Have you heard The Clash?
Mm-hmm.
And seeing The Jam in November, I think it would have been, of 76, on Top of the Pops, playing In the City, and just going, they're our age. I mean, they're just a couple of years older. This is possible. And then the Radiators from Space are a local punk band.
Mm-hmm.
They have a song called Telecaster or something. I'm going to put my Telecaster to the television screen because I don't like what's going down. And it's a 12-bar thing. So you can play it. Then the Ramones arrive. This is all... this is probably now... early 77.
How far into the band are you now?
It was occasional rehearsing.
Mm-hmm.
We're playing, you know, the Eagles. You know, we're playing. I'm not telling you who's asked for what.
Who just asked for the Eagles?
We're playing the Moody Blues.
Uh huh.
We're playing, and
does have to like Ride My Seesaw and that kind of thing?
All that stuff. And we're playing the Rolling Stones, but turns out we're really crap at it. Like we actually aren't able to play other people's songs. So very early on, we start writing our own. It's easier, mm-hmm. and I'm standing there, and I just pick up a guitar.
Mm-hmm.
I play a chord. I hear another chord, and I go to it.
Who taught you the chords?
My brother, I guess, and I and then myself. But so people are looking at me going like, "What are you doing?" I said, "Come write. We can write our own songs." And it felt so much easier to me than trying to figure out somebody else's.
The other stuff was too sophisticated or too complicated. Which Stones songs did you love? Were you partial to?
I loved all the High Tide Green Grass collection. That was my favorite. But the one we tried to play was Jumpin' Jack Flash.
Uh-huh.
It was really bad. It was really bad.
Did you like that stuff from Out of Our Heads, all that R&B stuff?
No.
That's How Strong My Love Is, not that stuff.
No. It was like
so much
JoJo's
more
19 Nervous Breakdown, Painted Black.
So they're modern rock kind of.
Whatever.
It's not their R&B stuff.
No.
So what did was the Ramones the big punk influence on you, or was it
Ramones
the Clash?
More Ramones than the Clash, though we saw the Clash first.
But
we saw the Clash in 77,
mm-hmm.
In Dublin, and it was just extraordinary. I mean, there was a sense that somebody could die. There was an air of violence, of threat. It was in Trinity College. Their backdrop was the back of their first album, which was British Bobbies chasing people down the streets of, I don't know, Brixton or whatever. But of course, it meant Belfast to us, and people were gobbing. You felt it could go up in flames. This place. And they came out and they looked so extraordinary. I mean, Paul Simon looked like just like something from another planet. But it was like, forget Marlon Brando, forget Jimmy Dean, forget Elvis, forget everybody.
No one looked like that. Joe looked like, you know, he was going to lead the revolution right then and there.
Aggressive.
Just aggressive makeup. I mean, it was just, they were all on top of our head. It was really exciting. But their music, their melodies didn't connect with us the same way that the Ramones, which we saw a little later in the year, did. And then, of course, we had that, noted, but it was a TV producer had heard this young band was playing and that we wrote our own songs.
So what band did you want to be the most like at the beginning as you guys are starting your rehearsals? It's like the Ramones is...
The Ramones
is, we got to be like that.
They're the ones. But so we changed... We were called The Hype.
Uh-huh.
And during that period. But then, funny thing, you know, we started to listen to Patti Smith. We started to listen to television very early on. So we're now 17.
So the Ramones lead you into kind of like New York City punk rock people.
Yeah. Edge starts listening to Tom Verlaine. And suddenly those chords.
Simple, big.
Are just not, they're not the only alternative. Now we've got a different kind of language. And then the band, very early on, started finding different colors other than the primary ones. Primary colors of rock and roll, that is. You know.
So, the punk thing was just that style of the Ramones.
We'd play punk gigs, but we'd quickly gone on to something else. So I remember people shouting from the audience, "More punk and the Monkees!" the thing that went around Dublin at the time was, "They're not real punk. They're not real punk. They're from the suburbs, and they've poshies in the group." Like Adam would be there, you know, this completely middle class boy, and the skinheads would come up and say, "Are you punk?" And Adam would go, "Beg your pardon?"
Was David Bowie a big influence on you guys?
Yes.
And what did you gather? What did you get from him? What did you learn from that?
When I saw Johnny Lydon doing Pretty Vacant, a film of it on Top of the Pops, I thought that was the character at the back of Ziggy Stardust, the guy in the phone box. And if you think about it, but Bowie was much more responsible for the aesthetic of punk rock than he's given credit for. And so he was a big influence. The glam rock stuff was a big influence in 73, 74.
How did it influence you?
I put his pictures up in my bedroom. We played Suffragette City in that first wedding band phase. We learned other people's songs, by the way, because we were told that was the only way we would get gigs. And we wanted to get a van so we could get gigs. It was very funny. It was a vicious circle. But Bowie was... just an exotic... creature, just something from another world.
So you got a song out of him, you put his pictures up. Do you ever try and dress like...
No, but Gavin did. And Gavin and Googie were
in that group called the
Virgin Prunes. They were very influenced by that. Lou Reed was around that time. I mean, we'd be here for weeks talking about it because there was so much music. Mm-hmm. But you're right to bring Moe up because that showman thing that I responded to as a pubescent, like a prepubescent, with Elvis and Tom Jones, that side very quickly gravitated towards glam rock.
Am I missing something in terms of just trying to understand the full range of the early influences on you and what kind of shaped you musically just as beginning kids? I want to come back later on and talk more about Bob and the Beatles and all this stuff. But
yeah, I think you covered it.
Let me just also ask then about growing up. What was the role of religion for you as a kid? I mean, I know that you were raised Protestant. Your parents were, one was, mom was Catholic, and your dad, no.
The other way.
But what was your sense of religion as a youngster, as 10, 12, 14, 15? And did you go to church then? Did it mean much to you?
I thought... I just remember thinking...
I knew that we were different on our street because my mother was Protestant. And that she'd married a Catholic. And that was different. Because you went to different schools then. Mm-hmm. And so you didn't go to the neighborhood school. So you got on a bus to go to school. Mm-hmm. And so I suppose I picked that up. I picked up the courage they had had to follow through on
your
their
parents.
Love. Yeah, and to get married at a time of strong sectarian feeling in the country. I think I knew that was special. I couldn't quite figure out why my father would wait outside the church when my mother would take us to this little Church of Ireland thing. I thought that was odd. And why he didn't feel comfortable to go in there. And I couldn't really tell the difference between Catholicism and Protestantism even then.
It sounds like, from what you're saying, that religion kind of enforced on you a sense of, you got where you're getting at, like a sense of being different, and also a little sense of your parents' courage in practicing it the way they wanted. But did you feel religious when you went to church and pray? And, you know, did you have any, was there any, since religion is going to play such a long role with you?
Even then, I prayed more outside of the church than inside it. And
was there anything beyond what you would think that kids, not prayers to, oh, if you'll only do this for me, I'll do that and stuff like that, or is it?
Yeah, see, I think it gets back to these songs, you know, that I was listening to were prayers for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the rhetorical questions out of the mouth of Bob Dylan or John Lennon, how many roads must a man walk down? They weren't rhetorical to me. Mm-hmm. They were addressed to God.
Mm.
Which is interesting.
Explain that to me a little more. You thought they were talking to God?
For me, they became my prayers.
Uh-huh. That you were asking God.
Yeah, I mean, when Bob Dylan singing, how many...
deaths will it take to make people stop killing people,
etc., etc. I'm asking the same question, but I'm not asking it
in church.
I'm not asking it I'm not asking it to myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not asking it to the great outdoors. It's become a prayer for me. I realize it's a question I want to know the answer to, and I'm wondering, well, who do I ask that to? I'm not going to ask a school teacher how many roads does it take for a man to walk down before he knows that he's a man. I feel that is already a dialogue with God. Now, I don't know if Bob does or Bob didn't. Most people do sort of a classic folk idiom rhetorical question. But for me, so when he goes, when John Lennon sings, "Oh, my Lord, for the first time in my life, my eyes are open," I'm feeling that's like these songs have an intimacy for me, that's not just between people. I realize now that it's
who is God to you at this point?
I don't know.
Do you have a conceptualization of it as a?
I don't know, but I'm curious to find out at that point. But I don't see much of it in religion. I don't think so, because I would rarely be asking these questions inside the church. I mean, I see lovely, you know, I see some nice people hanging out in the church, and you know, occasionally when I'm singing a hymn like. Oh, yeah, if I can think of a good one. When I survey the wondrous cross, or be thou my vision, I'd go, something would stir inside of me. But basically,
religion left me cold.
So going to church organized religion was not your thing as a kid?
No.
Not at all.
Didn't want to be a priest or a clergyman.
Well, your early songs are about, being confused. I mean, not that, but they're about, trying to find truth and enlightenment and
bizarre
spirituality. I mean, at an age when anybody else your age would be writing about girls, and trouble.
Yeah, we sort of did it the other way around.
What, how do you account for that? That you skipped "I Want to Hold Your Hand" and you went right to "Where's God"?
Into the Mystic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It's Van Morrison would be the inverse in terms of the journey. I think, again, it's this turbulent period in, at 15, 16, the electrical storms that come with at that age, I think some kind of searching for a reason to believe in myself and a reason to be alive and all of that. So I think that's where it came from. And I went, I started to, there was, My friend Googie, we became friends because he was also a little different. His parents were not just Protestant; they were like there was some obscure cult of Protestant, like in America it would be like
Children of God,
cult, like
evangelical.
Yeah, but more like Pentecostal, almost like right up. And they were fascinating. So his father was like a preacher from the Old Testament, and he spoke constantly of the scriptures. And he collected around him, he must have a family of like 10 kids. And they collected cars and motorcycles and all kinds of stuff. You had the sense that the end was nigh.
Who and to prepare your best for friend it. At this
yeah.
time, and you're spending more time at his house than anywhere else?
Yes.
Than at your own house. You're
yes.
living with that family.
Yes. And occasionally I go to church with him.
This is a fire and brimstone kind of
a This is a fire and brimstone. They're going 3 times on a Sunday.
Uh-huh. And you're going with them?
Occasionally. Just to see what it's like. And though myself and Googie are laughing at the absurdity of some of this, some of the rhetoric is getting through to us. We don't realize it, mm-hmm. but we're being immersed in the scriptures, in the Holy Scriptures. That's really that's what we took away from this. Mm-hmm. This rich language, these ancient tracts of wisdom. And even though we were determined not to become like these people, who we think are a little mad.
Is that your first real exposure to the Bible,
to the language
of the Bible?
Yes. Yes. He's an operatic character, isn't he? He's amazing.
So because your father wasn't
No.
Your experience going to church is kind of tepid and just pro forma.
Yeah.
And this is so, in a household of your best friend's
yes.
father, a super religious household, you're now,
yes.
despite your rebellion, starting to soak in the words. And
yes.
Exactly. Fire and all this stuff.
Yes, sir.
So is that why, part of why were you writing so fucking serious songs?
I guess
when you're 19 or 18?
I guess that must be it.
I mean, really, everybody else is writing about puberty.
Yeah, no, it's a.
But how do you account for that seriousness of at 18?
This might be interesting for you. I don't know
because it's a path you never diverged from. So let's get it right.
here's I think here's the strange bit. Most of the people that you grew up with, you know, in black music, had a similar baptism of the spirit, right? Through, whether it's Marvin Gaye, mm-hmm. whether it's Otis Redding, I mean, all the music that probably dominated you, your awakening, and you know, a lot of black music comes out of the church.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is these performers felt they could not express their sexuality before God. They had to turn away.
Mm-hmm.
So rock and roll became backsliders' music. Okay? The music, they were running away from God.
Mm-hmm.
And I never, for some reason, believed that. And it's really odd. As I look back now, I go...
You never believed that rock and roll was for a kind of frivolous dance?
I never saw that as being sex. A choice, either or.
Uh-huh.
I never saw that, you know, you know, this sort of big choice. So people that either denied their religious instincts, okay, and followed the flesh and into, you know, sort of hedonistic expression of...
You're saying you never saw rock and roll music as the so-called devil's music is incompatible with religion. But why? Everybody else in the world didn't.
Everybody
your age.
Yes, everybody else was just saying. So if you did have
everything you're looking at,
yeah,
The Clash, Ramones, they were not out of some Bible study group.
Right.
You know, so you're looking at all these influences, and yet you've become a very serious... religious and thoughtful songs.
But look at the people who have formed my imagination. Bob Dylan.
Mm-hmm.
1976.
Mm-hmm.
He's going through similar stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You buy Patti Smith, and you know, you have a single, "Pissing in the River," is the B side.
Mm-hmm.
You put on her album Horses. Jesus died for somebody else's sins, but not mine.
Mm-hmm.
And she turns Van Morrison's Gloria into liturgy.
Ooh.
She's asking immediately, you know, that she's wrestling with these demons. Catholicism in her case. Right the way through to Wave, where she's talking to the Pope that only lasted a few months. Forget his name. And Easter. It's like, whoa, Bob Dylan, Patti Smith, anything, Bob Marley. It's all Pete Townsend. I start to realize that's why I'm attracted to all these people.
Because they're searching.
Yeah, and it turns out.
In it.
Yeah, and it turns out that they both. And it turns out that that the music that really turns me on is either music running toward God or away from God. But both. Both recognize the
need to search
the pivot. Mm-hmm. You know, let me try and put it better. Whether you're running away or whether you're running toward, God is at the center of the jaunt, and that's striking. So the blues. On one hand, running away. Gospel, you know, the Mighty Clouds of Joy, you know, singing the Swan Silver Tones, whatever. So I realized that's where I'm at. That's the music that turns me on.
Mm-hmm.
This side or that side. And I'm not intellectually able enough to understand that they're both the same. But I'm really attracted and I'm determined to put both together and in our music. And...
Was that an intellectual decision then, or an intuitive decision?
Intuitive decision.
And later you came to analyze it and figure out what it was about.
Now I realize that the blues are like the Psalms of David. That they here was this character, you know, living in a cave, whose outbursts were as much
criticism as praise. You know, there's David singing, "Oh, you call yourself, oh God, where are you when I need you? Call yourself God." Mm-hmm. This is King David singing these, and you're going, well, you know, this is the blues. But it's a relationship. Both deal with the relationship with God. That's really it. One, you're angry, and I've since realized, you know, that anger with God is very valid. You know, we wrote the song on the pop album. People were confused by it. Wake up, dead man. Jesus. Or go, Jesus, Jesus help me. I'm alone in this world, and a fucked up world it is too. Tell me the story, the one about eternity, the way it's all going to be. Wake up, dead man. Wake up, dead man.
You early on got into being part of a Bible study group. You and Larry and Edge, mm-hmm. called the Shalom, I read about. What brought that on?
We were in doing street theater, and this performance art I was telling you about. And we met some people who were madder than us. And they were a kind of inner city group who were living life like it was the first century AD, in the sense that they believed that they were expectant of signs and wonders, lived a kind of early church religion. It was a commune. People who had cash shared it. It was attractive to us because, in a way, our gang, Lipton Village, had lived like that anyway. You know, early days with the band, Ali paid my way, or my mates paid my way. We were attracted to these people. They were passionate, they were funny, and they seemed to have no material desires in the world. And the scripture reminded me, their exegesis, their teaching of the scriptures reminded me of those people whom I'd heard as a youngster in with Googie, but they weren't as mad. Nearly. But not as mad. But it was more of this, you know. And what I realize now, you know, looking back, it's just, you know, insatiable intellectual curiosity.
On your part.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I want to understand this. And later, you know, we meet Paul McGuinness, and he's going, this is a little odd here. What's going on here? And we sort of say, well, you know, I seem to be writing these songs. This is the way it's going. And he said, you know, these are very big questions. He said, I don't believe in God, but I understand that it's a very big question. Mm-hmm. And I understand that if you are the artist that I think you are, mm-hmm. you're going to want to explore this. So go ahead. I mean, I was amazed. I mean, you'd think, I'm a manager, would you say, would you, let's uh-huh. you know, cop these guys on. Uh-huh. But it got a little too intense, as it always does. It became a bit of a holy huddle. And what these people who are so full of inspirational teaching and great ideas about the world, they pretended that our dress, the way we looked, didn't bother them. But very soon it appeared that that was not the case. And they started asking questions about the music we were listening to. Why are you wearing earrings? Why do you have a mohawk? You know, why are you, you know, what's this all about? And we thought, oh, so this was, you know, there was a sort of a honeymoon period.
Was it a cult? Would you look back and call it a cult?
Christian cult. I mean, Christianity is full of them. Big cults we called, like Episcopalianism, it's a very big cult. It's just about size, really, the word.
But were they, now this is a pretty, you were starting, the group was going on, you're starting to become moderately successful in mm-hmm. your world I mean, clearly you've got a job here as a group. You're gonna be making this group. Were they trying to win you over for their own purposes, get you out of the group, or were they trying to co-opt the group? Was there that kind of dynamic?
No, they were. It turns out they just wished the group would go away. That's what they did.
They were trying to save your souls?
Yeah, okay. They wanted us, and I don't think they were worried about our souls. I just think they just thought this was a distraction, that this group thing, and that what was going on in the world was much more exciting than rock and roll. They weren't too far off there, because if I look back on that period, 76, 77, there was a lot going on in the world, spiritually. There was. And if you study theology or of any kind, Judeo-Christian, Islamic belief systems, you'll see they come in waves. And there was a very big wave breaking around about 1976, 1977. It's happening in the U.S. It's happening with, you know, Dylan. And lots of people were feeling it. And so there was something going on. But again, instinctively, I just didn't believe that this choice between the flesh and spirit was equated to the God I believed in. I just couldn't quite figure it. I just didn't buy it.
How did you quit that group?
I mean, yeah, and also, there was a lot of tension within you, too, between Adam and Paul versus you three.
Yeah, well, Adam just was having this, he was just being the best. He was a really great pop star. You know, he was like, he took to it like a duck to water. You can imagine. Finally, he gets to be the bass player in a happening band. And he wants to just go out and just, you know, eat the pizza. he just wants to take a big bite out of it. And
in my mind, I was going to prompt you with eat it all, eat it all up, and you went eat the pizza, which is much better.
Right. He just, so, you know, he just wanted to, you know, taste it. And so, and I understand why. And he couldn't figure out why his bandmates were.
Was he angry?
No. He was actually really cool about it. So
and Paul was thinking.
I mean, I'm sure there was a few raised eyebrows. And, I mean, there was definitely, if not eyes to heaven.
The worst tack you can take is to confront, I guess. And so they were a little
something. Just kind of, look, Paul was very respectful as.
So you didn't feel a deep division in a band over this?
At times it was difficult. And remember, we had just come out of a situation where this very intense experience with this group called Shalom were trying to pull us in one direction.
Mm-hmm.
We were also determined not to be pulled in the other direction. We just wanted to be ourselves.
How did you end up leaving that? Or just one day not go, or one day say goodbye? Or
I just think we just go in on tour.
And just forgot to come back.
No, I'm just, you know, we visit. You know, I have such respect. I still miss the teaching of the this inspired man. It was just brilliant at bringing the scriptures to light. I mean, you don't get that many places.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, you know, sound thinking. This is not
kind of a replacement for Googie's father in a way.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, he's. I mean, these are not. This is not mad, you know. Snake biting, Pentecostal stuff. This is sound exegesis, and it was just very intense and demanding a surrender.
So if you're going to study the teaching, sooner or later you have to start living by the teaching.
Yes. If you're going to study the teaching. It demanded a kind of rejection of the world, really. And I think even then we understood that you can't escape the world wherever you go, least of all in very intense religious meetings, which can be more corrupt and more bent in terms of the pressures they exert on people than the outside forces.
You want to go engage.
I just thought, you know, just yeah. I mean, I thought, you know, because there is a thing, you know, you know, definitely with Edge and myself, we felt, well, you know, what more could you do with your life than to try and, you know, change the world, make it a better place.
This is RollingStone.com.